Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of conviction and courage fueled the activism of Americans who began campaigning against slavery long before the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter? The PBS series American Experience tonight debuts the first of a three-part exploration of the lives of some of the most influential figures in the movement who approached the fight for emancipation with everything from pacifist prayer to bloody conflict. John Stauffer is professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard University and author of multiple books, including Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. He is featured as an expert commentator in The Abolitionists, which can be seen in North Texas this evening at 8 on KERA television. John, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be on the air with you.
So this film opens with the story of Angelina Grimke, who is fascinating because her initial objection to her own family's vast investment in owning slaves was that she believed the system inherently violated Christian doctrine. How was the early abolitionist movement tied into people's religious beliefs?
It was inseparable from their religious beliefs. You really can't think of abolitionism without understanding the degree to which they acted on their religious principle. And for someone like Angelina Grimke and most other abolitionists, they had to grapple religiously with the fact that there was a long history of ministers of religious doctrine and theology, of numerous statements in the Bible that seemed to defend slavery. And so Angelina and Frederick Douglass and most of the other abolitionists concluded that they understood directly from God that slavery was a horrible evil that needed to be outlawed.
You know, I knew that slavery made the wealth of the agricultural South possible, but I didn't realize until watching this piece that slaves were the largest single financial asset of the United States as a whole in the 1830s.
Yep, that's correct.
Wow.
That's correct. In fact, the easiest way to become rich if you were in the South is to acquire a slave before you acquired land, before you acquired anything else. And the one commodity from 1830 to 1860 that went up virtually every year with the exception of one or two years in the 1850s was the price of slaves. Cotton fluctuated, land fluctuated, other commodities fluctuated, value, price of slaves continued to go up. And the richest Americans, without question, two-thirds of the wealthiest Americans were Southern slave owners.
So how did the slave system sort of play into the balance of not just economic but also political power in the antebellum United States?
It was also inseparable from political power. Slave owners from beginning in the 1830s until the Civil War, really, from the perspective of anti-slavery Northerners, really took control of the federal government and successfully expanded slavery through the Mexican War and the acquisition of the Western territories. There was a successful attempt for 8 years among Southerners to silence any discussion of slavery in Congress because slave owners understood the power of abolitionist rhetoric. The words and weapons of abolitionists were the most potent weapons available. And so the gag rule, silence any discussion, that was repealed. And the major federal acts were acts over slavery, whether it was the Missouri Compromise beginning in the 1820s or the annexation of Texas, which opened the way to a degree to the Mexican War because of the boundary dispute, and then the Compromise of 1850 in which Southerners threatened to secede if they did not get a rigorous fugitive slave law passed. Southerners were hoping to have in the Compromise California enter the Union as a slave state. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opens northern territories, the Dred Scott decision, all of these major, crucial federal acts of legislation were acts that benefited slavery and slaveholders. And it's important to see that American slave owners in the 1850s, had grown. If you were, say, 60 years old in 1860, you had grown up. You, as a young boy, slavery had been a fact of life. In 1800, very few places, there were virtually only a handful of states at that time in the North that had abolished slavery, and slavery was legal everywhere else in the Western Hemisphere. And suddenly there's this huge tidal wave of anti-slavery movement throughout Western culture. So by 1850, the only places in the New World in which slavery was still legal were the U.S. South, Cuba, Brazil, and Dutch Guiana. And so these slave owners are feeling on the defensive, and they're hoping to reverse this wave of emancipation that's sweeping Western culture.
And, you know, it's easy to make the mistake, if we are not professional historians like you, of oversimplifying the way the debate over slavery played out so that we see, you know, South equals pro-slavery, North equals anti-slavery. The film makes a good point of letting us know how much pro-slavery activity was taking place in the northern United States, not simply because there were these federal laws that sort of bolstered the right of the South to have slaves, but there was all kinds of bounty hunting activity taking place, kind of in full view of everybody on the street.
Yes, and northerners also benefited immensely from slavery. The industry in the North, especially the textile manufacturers, but not only the textile manufacturers, benefited immensely from slavery. A slave who escapes to New York City refers to New York City, which by 1850s is the largest city in the country, as a virtual annex of South Carolina because it was so pro-slavery. And so the abolitionists, a self-described abolitionist, as the film makes clear, they were a tiny despised minority because they not only advocated the immediate end to slavery, which is frankly a social revolution, because it was such a foundational industry and institution in the United States, and that ending it immediately was a social revolution. But also, in theory, abolitionists advocated blacks as citizens, as advocating equality before the law, and that was also deeply threatening to northern whites, especially working class whites, who felt that they didn't want to, did not want to have to compete with blacks. And so racism, one of the ironies is that racism increases dramatically at the same time that anti-slavery and the abolitionist movement pick up steam.
I just want to clarify, when you talk about the importance of the slave system to the northern textile industry, the issue there was cheap cotton, essentially, was available because of slavery.
Yes, cheap cotton. In fact, southern cotton, or southerners, grew the majority of the world's cotton. And most of it was manufactured in England. But the northerners were really the financiers, and particularly outside of Boston, textile manufacturers of the cotton. And so they made their millions, they made their money on really the backs of these southern growers of cotton using slave labor.
So in any story about American abolitionism, of course, William Lloyd Garrison is going to be a key figure. And his sense was deeply tied to his evangelical sensibilities, to the extent that he thought that slaveholders might be saved in the same way that people were sort of saved from not believing in God, instantaneously.
Yes, he would. I think seeing him as an evangelical is a wonderful parallel. I mean, in many respects, he was, because he believed that humans were flawed, they were sin, and that, like evangelicals today, you have to get right with God. You have to be willing to repent of your sins and then act differently. And that leads to this conversion experience, and the conversion experience brings about a new individual. And every abolitionist saw themselves as born again, not only through God, but through their abolitionism. And part of evangelicalism today is that a righteous evangelical is expected to bear witness to Christ. Abolitionists bore witness to the evils of slavery, and in so doing, they believe they were also bearing witness to God, to Christ.
How did Garrison's life change when he lived among free blacks in Baltimore?
It changed dramatically. One of the, if you look at abolitionists, white abolitionists across the board, probably the single common denominator distinguishing those white abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison, like John Brown, like Garrett Smith, like a few others, who felt entirely comfortable around blacks, who were able to explode the racism that simply marinated American society, were those whites who spent a lot of time actually among blacks, eating with them, living with them, working with them, because that helped to explode the abstraction of racism. The whites who spent little time around blacks, almost to a man and a woman, showed a far greater degree of what scholars call a kind of paternalism. And that usually manifested itself by expecting blacks to embrace the manners, the customs, the sense of respectability that whites considered central to being a citizen and an American.
So in 1831, Garrison begins his own abolitionist newspaper called The Liberator. What were the challenges of sort of selling subscriptions and building a reader base for a publication like that at that time?
They were huge. The other examples of abolitionist newspapers, there's a black paper from 1827-28 that went under. So the biggest problem is funding, and then right after Garrison started publishing it, as the film makes clear, within a few months, within the same year that he starts publishing it in the fall, the Nat Turner slave revolt. And there's no evidence that Nat Turner had been influenced by Garrison's Liberator. But Southerners made the connection between Garrison publishing his Liberator and Nat Turner's rebellion. And so a number of states put a bounty on Garrison's head, encouraging a bounty hunter to go capture Garrison and bring him back to the Southern state and try him for libel. Because in the Southern states, Garrison's newspaper was seen as incendiary, meaning unlawful, meaning it was a paper that advocated a revolution that was that would lead Garrison to be imprisoned or worse. So that was Garrison. You know, Garrison was lucky in one sense to survive. In Boston itself, a mob attacked him. He was almost lynched on the streets of Boston. And this was immediately after, in the immediate wake of Garrison organizing a female convention in which women would speak out publicly. So Garrison's radicalism wasn't only about blacks being not only free but citizens, but women enjoying the same rights as of equality and as citizens as men. And it was for women to speak publicly, to have a public voice, was seen as outrageous for most men. And he was, you know, he could have easily been lynched in Boston that day, and he could have easily been killed numerous other points in his life. So simply surviving was a major hurdle and ultimately success for Garrison. And his earliest subscribers, and he understood this, his paper survived in the early years because of black subscriptions. His newspaper was considered so radical that few whites subscribed and read it. Most of his early readers were African American.
My guest is John Stauffer, professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard, author of multiple books, including Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. He appears tonight in the American Experience documentary, The Abolitionist, which premieres this evening on PBS nationally, including on KERA-TV in North Texas this evening at 8. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Stauffer. He is professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard and the author of multiple books of history, including Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. John Stauffer appears in the American Experience three-part documentary, The Abolitionists, which will premiere at 8 o'clock tonight on KERA television in North Texas and on PBS stations all over the country. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. John, why was Garrison so unwilling to consider any kind of aggressive tactics or violent tactics to end slavery?
He wasn't until the Civil War. He changes. I'm giving away the third part. But he wasn't because Garrison understood that violence was the very bolt around which slavery depended. Mm-hmm. Without violence, there is no slavery. And so to accept violent means to end slavery is to participate in the very evil that's at the root of that institution.
So talk about how William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass came to know each other, to work together, and then ultimately to grow apart.
Garrison met Frederick Douglass when Douglass went to Nantucket for a anti-abolition convention in 1841, and Douglass was living and working in New Bedford, Connecticut. He had spoken to primarily blacks in New Bedford and was considered an excellent speaker already. And in Nantucket, he was asked to speak and was initially very nervous because he said that he had never spoken to so many whites before. And he got up and he gave a very powerful address, and Garrison heard it and was so impressed that he essentially hired him to become a full-time paid lecturer for the American Anti-Slavery Society. This was really important for Garrison and the American Anti-Slavery Society, because at the time that he hired Douglass, American Anti-Slavery Society did not have any other ex-slaves who could speak firsthand on the power of slavery. And there was a great need for this. So Douglass, just telling his life story, just telling about his experience in slavery, was a powerful, potent way of converting people to the cause of anti-slavery or abolitionism. And so they had a very close relationship for the first several years. In fact, Frederick Douglass said when he escaped from slavery and moved to New Bedford, he read The Liberator religiously. He said that The Liberator was as sacred as his Bible in terms of reading it regularly. And so it was through The Liberator that he became familiar with American Anti-Slavery Society and abolition organizations. It's through The Liberator that he learned about a conference like the Nantucket Conference. And the American Anti-Slavery Society transferred Douglass to Lynn, Massachusetts, in part because Lynn at the time was a railroad hub, so it would be easier for Douglass to travel around the North to abolitionize northern communities. And from the time he was a full-time paid lecturer for the American Anti-Slavery Society, Douglass essentially was on the road most of the time, gave thousands of speeches, the crowds kept growing. I mean, he quickly came to be considered the most powerful, brilliant orator in the American Anti-Slavery Society. And he was also a very big, tall man, had a very sturdy constitution. And at that time, because of the comparatively primitive nature of travel, it was really grueling. And there are examples of Douglass. For example, when he goes to Buffalo, New York, it's a raw frontier town, and this is in the early 1840s. And he goes with one other speaking partner, John Collins, who's a white man, and they arrive at Buffalo, which is a thriving, bustling town. But Douglass said everybody, just all they care about is making money. They don't seem interested in abolition. And the venue that they had reserved for them was this dilapidated old post office, and the only crowd they had that first for that first speech were five hackmen or cabbies, dust covered their clothes, whips in their hand, and John Collins, the white speaking partner, was so frustrated and upset at Rochester, he didn't even stay to give his talk. He took the next steamboat down to Ohio. So Douglas said he was left to do Buffalo himself. He spoke to the five cabbies that first day. Within 10 days or 12 days, there wasn't a building large enough to contain the audience who wanted to hear him speak. He spoke on the Village Green, the largest space available, and he estimated it was to roughly between a third and a half of the population. That's how powerful Douglas was as a public speaker. And Garrison himself was a brilliant public speaker. This was an age in which public speaking was one of the few forms of entertainment, so that people would come from miles just to hear a great public speaker. It was similar to being a professional athlete or a rock star today. And so to be a very effective public speaker carried an immense amount of cultural weight. And Douglas and Garrison had great respect for each other, and it was really because Douglas was so brilliant as a speaker and had such a way with words that led him to write and publish his first autobiography, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, in 1845, and he did so because increasingly, as he kept traveling, audiences started accusing him of being a fraud, essentially saying, you're so good as a speaker, you have such a talent for language, there's no way you could have been a slave. There's no way you could not have had any formal education. And the most important asset of an abolitionist order, especially someone like Douglas, was truth-telling. And being accused of being a fraud is profoundly threatening to what he does. So he decides that he's going to write his autobiography and tell everything, name who his masters were. When he's on the speaking platform, he doesn't say exactly where he's from and who his masters are because he's still a fugitive. He could easily be captured and sent back into slavery. But after the accusations of fraud, he publishes his autobiography, says exactly where he's from, who his masters are, and that leads him to be sent to the British Isles for 2 years because the American Anti-Slavery Society realizes his life is in danger after that narrative becomes a bestseller. And in fact, he was. One of his former masters, Hugh Auld, had went on record, published in the local Baltimore newspaper, essentially an article saying he would go to any length possible to recapture Douglas.
We're lucky that he came back because he loved it in
He loved
Britain.
It there. And in the British Isles, he said it was the first instance in which he experienced a complete dearth of racism. He said he could walk down the streets and people wouldn't spit and yell the N-word at him. He could walk into any public establishments. He loved it there, and he became very close friends with a number of very highly respected British men and women. And he came back principally because he felt an obligation to his fellow black men and women. He came back because of that sense of obligation. In fact, he says in his second autobiography in 1855, he says, you know, I had no loyalty to the United States. Why should I? Look what it had done to me. I came back because of an obligation to people like myself.
So, obviously, Frederick Douglass had a very close relationship early on to William Lloyd Garrison. It's interesting that sort of on the other end of the spectrum of abolitionist activity, he was also somewhat close to John Brown.
Yes, he was. He first meets John Brown in 1847, and this is a period of transition and a profound transition in Douglass's life when he comes back to the United States in 1847. He wants to become a newspaper editor. He wants to start his own newspaper because at the time that was seen as much more prestigious than simply being an orator, because it essentially reflected a sign of being an intellectual, being a kind of scholar, whereas orators were not necessarily seen that way. And Douglass had always been more ambivalent about Garrison's fairly rigid stance on pacifism and on what Garrison called non-resistance, meaning non-voting, seeing government as corrupt. After all, the climactic major event in Douglass's first narrative is his fight with Edward Covey. And Douglass is increasingly sensitive to to politics. And but more than anything, he doesn't want to start a newspaper and have to compete with the Liberator. He understands how brilliant Garrison is as a journalist. And Rochester, upstate New York, was the hotbed of political abolitionism in much the same way that Boston, where Garrison lived, was the hotbed of Garrisonian or non-resistant abolitionism. And Rochester is also a boom town. There are a number of printers there. And so he starts his Frederick Douglass's paper. And Garrison actually felt he felt betrayed because he had been a mentor to Douglass. He had hired Douglass. Douglass left really without telling him. Garrison had been very sick during a speaking tour. It was a kind of nasty aspect to their relationship. I think part of it was that Garrison and it was also and Douglass were also competitive. You know, both of them were great public speakers. Both of them understood how important public speaking and words were. Garrison himself was essentially a self-made man like Douglass. His father had been a drunk. He came from nothing, to see his Frederick Douglass, his great mentee, you know, abandoned him to go to Rochester to publish in the rival newspaper, and then in 1851 to become a political abolitionist when Garrison considered the Constitution pro-slavery and corrupt. He considered that a betrayal, and Garrison was held grudges, I'll say, longer than Douglass did, and didn't even want to be at an abolition conference with Douglass throughout the 1850s. But to his credit, after the Civil War broke out, he and Douglass reunited. Both men as leaders had this great capacity for kind of rapprochement or forgiveness, and they ended in the Civil War and thereafter, and near the end of their life, they both had only really truly great things to say about each other. And in a sense, felt sorry or felt uncomfortable about this decade of pretty serious tension.
And with regard to the relationship between Douglass and John Brown, it wasn't like the question over violent tactics was an elephant in the room. This is something they spoke about pretty candidly.
Yes. So Douglass meets John Brown, and the difference for Douglass between John Brown and Garrison was that both were zealous, both were fervent. But John Brown had already had a lot more experience around African Americans even than Garrison did. Brown was already a thorough bankrupt, and in fact Douglass's he wrote a letter in his newspaper that he published in his newspaper after he had first met John Brown. He said, although John Brown is a white man, he is so fervently opposed to slavery, he acts like a black man. He said, I've never met anyone like this. And he has no compunction using violence. Because from Brown's perspective, and Douglass could understand and appreciate this, which is why Douglass was more ambivalent about violence, from Brown's perspective, slavery is a state of war. Slavery itself is warfare between master and slave. After all, it depends upon violence. And so from Brown's perspective, and Douglass increasingly came to endorse this, the United States is engaged in a civil war, and we're peacemakers. If we're peacemakers, the goal is to end slavery as swiftly as possible, certainly preferably using nonviolence. But if nonviolence isn't going to work to end slavery right away, we have to be willing to use violence. We have to be willing to use to basically fight the devil with his own fire.
Talk a little bit about the depiction of John Brown in the film, because it seems here he comes across as pretty endorsing the use of violence, but we don't really see the sort of wild-eyed John Brown that he's somehow sometimes depicted as. We hear over time that he may have struggled with mental illness. Do you think the John Brown we see in The Abolitionist is gels with your sense of who he was as a human being?
Yeah, I do. I think the film is very good. You'll see different versions of Brown and couple nights. He evolves over the course of the film, but I think it's impossible to really understand Brown without understanding his most outrageous act, where he goes to Kansas in 1855 to join some sons and sons-in-law who are already there. Kansas-Nebraska Act had already opened Kansas to slavery, and so it's already a battleground between pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces. And the town of Lawrence, Massachusetts, is sacked and burned by pro-slavery people, and it's truly a civil war is already occurring there. And Brown, basically, you know, as a retaliatory measure, enters the Pottawatomi Creek settlement and rounds with five sons and sons-in-law, rounds up, you know, five pro-slavery settlers, unarmed, and has his men hack them to death with broadswords as a retaliatory measure. As a way of kind of co-opting the possibility that he would get killed as well. I mean, that was just, he was a warrior. Another way of distinguishing someone like Garrison and John Brown is that John Brown did not have the talent for language or words that Douglas or Garrison did. John Brown had a hard time writing a grammatically correct sentence. John Brown's defined himself as a warrior. That's who he was. And for abolitionists, being, especially by the 1850s, in which violence had escalated at all levels, the willingness to use violence, and especially in self-defense, had escalated dramatically. Garrison and a number, in fact, there were a number, Garrison was a holdout. There were a number of Garrisonians who went to Kansas and argued that they were still Garrisonians, even though they were willing to kill pro-slavery settlers in Kansas, because they said, they're not men, they're beasts. They're not men, they're beasts. And so the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Fugitive Slave Law, as part of the Compromise of 1850, had a dramatic impact on the abolitionists' willingness to use violence, because so many slave catchers came north, capturing slaves in the front of everyone, of citizens in free communities in the North. It really had a profound effect.
John Stauffer is with us from Harvard. He appears tonight in the American Experience documentary, The Abolitionists. It's a three-part series that starts this evening nationally on PBS stations. We will take your calls and emails after the break. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard University, John Stauffer. He is the author of multiple books, including Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. Tonight on PBS stations across the country is the first part of the three-part American Experience documentary series, The Abolitionists. You can see it on KERA television this evening at 8. Our number is 1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to ask a question. And we have Jack on the line in Grand Prairie. Hi, Jack.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Yeah. Just wondered if you knew anything about Lysander Spooner, who was an abolitionist and founder of the Libertarian Party.
Yes. Yes.
And Tucker, the same, too, I think. And, you know, we know very little about the Libertarian Party, and it's so often mentioned today and, you know, part of the Vogue, but... So I just kind of wondered about that.
It's a great question. So Lysander Spooner was very important to the political abolitionists. Political abolitionists distinguished themselves from the Free Soil Party and the Republican Party in that Free Soilers and, say, Lincoln, who is representative, Lincoln believed that the Constitution generally was anti-slavery, but that the Constitution guaranteed slavery in the states through various clauses. And Lysander Spooner and the political abolitionists, meaning the Liberty Party, then the National Liberty Party and the Radical Abolition Party, and Douglas was a member of, and John Brown, too, of the Radical Abolition Party, and Douglas of the Liberty Party, believed that the Constitution did not sanction slavery anywhere. And they, so interpreting the Constitution, they had to ignore 80 years of legal precedent. But they said that, for example, the preamble of the Constitution emphasizes freedom. The words slave, slavery, and Negro are never mentioned in the Constitution. And the Fugitive Slave Clause refers to children, not slaves, etc. I mean, it was actually a very creative interpretation of the Constitution. The upshot is that Lysander Spooner was a crucially important thinker and writer for these political abolitionists. Frederick Douglass, Gerrit Smith, John Brown was less active, but also active as a radical abolitionist. And Spooner became a kind of founding figure of the Libertarian Party because of his really amazingly creative ways of reinterpreting the Constitution. It's frankly, from one perspective, anarchic, because the legal system in the United States is based on precedent. And to ignore the long history of precedent and say, here's my interpretation of the Constitution, that is something that libertarians love, but it also is easy to ignore precedent.
Okay, so we all know that Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freed the slave, but is it inaccurate to call Abraham Lincoln any kind of abolitionist?
Yes, it is. He actually never... distanced himself very explicitly from being an abolitionist. He was anti-slavery, so it's very important, and the film makes this clear, that throughout the period of the film, from 1830s to 1860s, the crucial difference between an abolitionist and an anti-slavery advocate was an anti-slavery advocate believed, like abolitionists, that slavery was an evil that needed to be abolished. But the abolitionists advocated immediate emancipation, immediate end to slavery. It's such a horrible evil that we cannot tolerate its ongoing existence. The anti-slavery advocates, and Lincoln here is representative, advocated a very gradual end to slavery. In this sense, they were like the founding fathers, George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, especially early on. All believed in theory that slavery was evil. They were slave owners themselves, but felt that over the course of 60 or 100 years, let's end slavery. And that's a very gradual means of ending slavery prevents the kind of social revolution and chaos of uprooting society. And Lincoln was, and other anti-slavery advocates were in the same vein. I mean, Lincoln's platform was the ultimate extinction of slavery, and when pressed in his debates with Stephen Douglas about when that ultimate extinction of slavery would occur, Lincoln said not less than 100 years, which would mean 1968 at the earliest. And that's Lincoln is representative in so many ways of anti-slavery Northerners. For abolitionists, that's way too tardy. The other crucial distinction between anti-slavery advocates and abolitionists is that many, if not most, anti-slavery advocates, including Lincoln, endorsed colonization, meaning that with the freeing of slaves, they should be colonized to another country, whether or not because the racism was so great that they would not be able to live as citizens or freemen, or because of their racism. And one of the defining aspects of an abolitionist is they had come to see in the colonization movement the profound racist aspect of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi. What a great show, as always, Chris, and a nice bookend for both the first and second hour about American civil rights. I had a question. Could the guest comment a little bit about Henry Beecher and Beecher's Bibles and how that played an effect in the Bleeding Kansas issues during the 1850s?
Yeah, that's another great question. So Henry Ward Beecher, the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who's one of the leading figures in the abolitionist film, was in the 1850s already one of, if not the preeminent ministers in the United States, certainly the North. And he was an fervently anti-slavery minister. And after the Kansas-Nebraska Act passes, opening Kansas to a slave state, turning it into a battleground, essentially many of the immigrants to Kansas from the north who went to Kansas, some to settle, some to really fight to preserve freedom in Kansas, were from Massachusetts and the New England states, and to a lesser degree in the area in New York. And Henry Ward Beecher knew a lot of people, knew a lot of the immigrants to Kansas, so he sent these boxes, these long boxes, and he labeled them Beecher's Bibles. What was inside of them were guns. Hmm. To aid these immigrants to Kansas, because they knew it was warfare. It's one of the reasons why, within that same context, someone like John Brown as a warrior was not seen as out of the that dramatically out of the ordinary. If you were in Kansas from 1855, really with a few down periods from 1855 through the Civil War, It was bloody. It was civil war.
The film does a great job in reminding us the extent to which Harriet Beecher Stowe's personal tragedy really allowed her to understand enslaved people as entirely human and people with whom anybody could empathize.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Stowe, I teach Uncle Tom's Cabin usually every year. And she, both her story of experiencing her own child's death and then seeing slave women have their children yanked from them and sold off, she is brilliant at being able to empathize with another person, being able to understand the feelings, the horrors, the emotions of another person. And that was central. That's a central common theme of the abolitionists. Because after all, if you're a free white person of wealth and you can empathize with the plight of a slave, that goes a great way in propelling you to take action. And it was that her own experience of her having a child die and of witnessing slave children being sold off that prompted her to write a book that she hoped would make a difference.
Back to the phones now. Next we have Jan on the line in Oak Cliff. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Jan. You have an interesting group of topics today. This question might be a little bit more geared to Mr. Levine, who I think is coming on this afternoon, but in this Sunday's New York Times, in the Weekend Review section, they had an article that was about how emancipation was really probably the worst thing that could ever happen to the African-American groups. That suddenly they were free. They had nothing to rely on. They had nowhere to go. They had no income. They were still thought of as very poorly. And none of the people who actually created the Emancipation Act did it for them. They did it as a political strategy and a military tactic to weaken the South. This article claims that tens and tens and tens of thousands of freed slaves died very horrible deaths because of this.
I have not read the piece, John, but are you familiar with that line of thinking?
Yes, I am. So it's a fascinating question. It's a great question. So the argument is, for listeners who didn't read the article, is that, you know, emancipation brings about the disease, the death from disease, and the many scholars and historians have described the period, especially after the era of Reconstruction, of a period of worse than slavery, because lynching becomes a fact of life throughout the South. And whereas slaves, there was a disincentive to kill your slave because of the value of it. When you're a disenfranchised black, there's no penalty, really, for murdering or killing a black in most Southern communities. The question that, you know, it, essentially your question is, it becomes a counterfactual question. and that is, you know, what are the alternatives? There's a long history of scholarship on the Civil War in which scholars argued the mainline argument was that, gee, you know, the Civil War was a catastrophe because the Civil War, which begins really as a Union War, but we now know from scholars like Jim Oakes's new book, and he has a piece in the New York Times Opinionator today, that the war, although it might begin as a war to preserve the Union, very quickly, far more quickly than most scholars have acknowledged, it becomes a war to end slavery, that the two are inseparable. For earlier scholars, that war was a catastrophe because of all the deaths, but they also argued slavery wasn't that bad, and look at the plight of blacks after slavery. And had the war not occurred, they argued that slavery was not the kind of profitable institution it was. They argued that slavery would have ended within 20 or 30 years anyway, and had it ended peacefully, then African Americans would have been far better off. I don't believe that's the case. So the question is, had it not been, had there been no emancipation, had there been no civil war that is the crucial catalyst for emancipation, and that everyone knows today how horrible chattel slavery is, what's the solution?
Can you talk about this? Of the abolitionist figures that we have discussed this afternoon, is there one of them that could have imagined the state of the United States in 2013?
That's a great question. There was an article in Garrison's Liberator in early 1830s, and it was called A Dream. And we don't know who exactly the author is. He just signed it TT. I've actually written about it. I think it might be Thomas Tracy, a New England abolitionist. But in any event, it's a dream. It's a piece of fiction, but it's a wish, a dream of what might happen. Basically, in this dream, the abolition movement is immensely successful. It converts the majority, most Americans, to the cause of abolitionism, slavery within 20 years or 10 years, and very quickly. In fact, it's in the space of a young sapling growing into a medium-sized tree, and so it's, you know, 10 or 20 years. Slavery is ended immediately, and at the end of his dream, there's a soiree in which blacks and whites interact, they're clearly friends, and the first black president of the United States has just been elected. This is written in 1833-34.
John Stauffer is professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard University. He is featured as an expert commentator in the American Experience documentary The Abolitionist, which premieres tonight on PBS stations across the country. John, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast for free and learn more about the show at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.